Production. Recorded live.
Hey everybody, it's Tracy Brown. Thanks so much for joining Intentionally Inclusive. Oh my goodness, this has been and continues to become such an amazing series. I'm getting to talk to all kinds of folks, ministers, practitioners, licensed Unity teachers, lay people who are leaders in different volunteer ministries and roles, and I am having a blast. So I hope you've been listening to some of the recordings and you too are enjoying these conversations about what it takes to be an intentional leader in spiritual communities, an intentionally inclusive leader who is able to not only accept or attract diversity, but to create environments where teams are working well together, where outreach to the community is working, and where everyone is growing in love with diversity. If you've not been to the website stainedglassspirit.net, I encourage you to do so. We update the website several times a month with tips and ideas, resources that you might be able to use, and information that hopefully inspires you to be inclusive in your spiritual community. And in addition, you can find links there for upcoming webinars, programs, and beginning in June of 2014, you can also find links to the Intentionally Inclusive Masterclasses, which allow you to really drill down at a self-study pace into specific things that you can do, specific ideas you can implement to increase your diversity welcome factor, to really assess and improve your inclusion worship factor, and other aspects of diversity and inclusion. But today, I get to focus for the next 55 minutes or so on one specific conversation. And I'm so excited that my guest today is Reverend Martha Quintana. And I'll tell you, one of the reasons I'm excited about it is because while I do know Reverend Martha, I don't know her that well. So I'm looking forward to getting to know her better and hearing her perspective on what it means to be an intentionally inclusive leader. So let's do a quick sound check. Reverend Martha, are you with us?
I am here. Thank you, Tracy.
Oh, that sounds great. Nice and clear. And you are hearing me nice and clear as well?
I am. Thank you.
Perfect. So you know what the series is about. It's about being an intentionally inclusive leader in spiritual communities. But before we really dive into that, I'm just curious if you would share a little bit about your own personal path to ministry. And I think I'm going to have a couple of questions about that. But what was your path to ministry?
Wow. Well, it started when I was really little. I just knew when I was like 4 years old, I knew that I was going to grow up and be a priest, was the word that I used at the time, because that's what I knew. And so over time in the tradition I grew up with, I found out by the time I was seven that in that particular tradition that girls did not grow up to be priests, and I was very disillusioned. I was very disappointed by that. I remember thinking, "Oh my God, what do you mean?" You know, I was talking to the head sister at the time, and she said that girls could not be priests, and I said, "Are you sure? Are you sure that, you know?" And because I just knew it in my heart. I just knew it. And so over time, that and a couple of other things, the other thing that happened at the time that was that shook me to my core, but I didn't realize till later what that would lead me particularly here, was I was the year prior, I was 6 years old, and I was had gone with my grandmother to clean the cemetery. And in those days, they called it Decoration Day. And in Spanish, I grew up in northern New Mexico, and in Spanish, the word for cemetery is Camposanto. Camposanto means holy ground. And so we were cleaning the cemetery, the Camposanto, and I noticed right outside the fence that there was a grave. So I saw that someone had been buried outside holy ground. And so I was very shook up by this. And I turned to my grandmother and I said, "Who's that?" You know, because even I at 6 years old knew that was a big deal to be buried outside holy ground. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Oh," she said, that woman died giving birth to a baby out of wedlock. And I was so upset. And I said, "Well, where's the dad?" And she pointed to the middle of the cemetery. And so it just shook me to my core that you could be thrown outside of holy ground for something like having a baby. I thought that was a holy thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I find out the following year, I find out that women can't be priests. So it set me into over time disillusionment. And so by the time I graduated high school, I was an atheist. And that path led me to play very dark places and to places where it was not good for my soul. And so by the time I was in my late 20s, I found 12-step programs. And so a woman in one of the meetings one night said to me, "If you want what we have, Martha, you have to have a power greater than you." And I thought, oh, that was okay. I mean, if whatever they said, I wanted what they had, which was to be happy, because I had not been happy. And so I went home that night and got down my knees, because that's what people said they did. And I was so mad. I was so mad. I just yelled into the room. "Okay, if you're there, you have to show yourself to me. If you're so omniscient and omnipresent and omni-everything, then you need to show yourself to me, because I don't even know what to think about you."
Mm-hmm.
And so right then the feeling started coming over me that was so huge that it scared me, and I shut it down. I just shut my brain down so I couldn't think about it. And I went around like that for two or three days till I got too tired, and it came, and she came, and it was a spiritual experience. And in the spiritual experience, the goddess came, and she said she was coming to me in that form so that I would know the power of the feminine and the power of healing. And so it took me a little bit to readjust to that whole idea, because I had grown up with a very patriarchal sort of deity. And so I went along like that. And then when I was 35, I had a baby out of wedlock. And so I realized that if I died, I was a single mom. And I realized that if I passed away, that my daughter would be brought up in the tradition of my childhood. And I truly did not want that. So it set me out looking for a spiritual community. And I found First Church of Religious Science on San Pedro. And my daughter, she was only like 19 or 20 months old at the time, she and I came to the community and fit right in. And then I had another spiritual experience where I was reminded that when I grew up, I was going to be a priest. And so the little four-year-old Martha was talking to me, and so I took a foundations course and went to see the minister and asked him what I had to do to be a minister. And so he told me, and so that set my course toward ministry. Although looking back now, every single job I've ever had was training for this one. But so that's how it happened. So I just went through the courses and came through and got my ministerial license and degree. And so here we are today.
What a fabulous story. And, it, you know, our true lives, the reality of our true lives is so much better than anything we could imagine in fiction. You know, to really think back and realize, oh, I have been on this path since, you know, I was such a young child. And being clear that everything that happened in between really were puzzle pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So you grew up in New Mexico, and you live in Albuquerque now, I know this. I was going to say, and I'm assuming, but I actually know this, but just by the way you told the story, that you are bilingual, Spanish and English.
Yeah.
So how do you describe your racial ethnic identity?
I describe myself as Hispanic. My family comes from northern New Mexico. We've been there for over 400 years. We came over with a second wave of conquistadores with the land grants. And so in those days, because of the geography, the terrain up in northern New Mexico, it's in the southern tip of the Rocky Mountains, so it was very isolated. And so so the family stayed there, and the Spanish that was spoken up until my grandmother's generation, really, that's kind of faded away, but the Spanish that was spoken until my grandmother's generation would be really akin to coming across a 15th century Elizabethan English-speaking community. There were a lot of the words spoken there were, you know, kind of Middle Ages sort of Spanish. And but that was mainly because of the isolation of the culture. And so so that's where I grew up. So it's kind of, so we're kind of a quirky little group, you know. We're not we were kind of isolated off to ourselves, so that's why I call myself Hispanic, because we were in that group. There were a lot of people that came through. There are a lot of, in fact, they found there were a lot of what they call the hidden Jews, and as far as I can tell, they're not in, but we all knew who they were in that situation, but there were hidden Jews, people that went there to escape the Inquisition, and so it was a very isolated community with a very distinct culture.
I find that so interesting, and what you just triggered for me is how is this question, how would you react or respond to people who will say, well, because we are, you know, we all are one in the body of God. And so, you know, that's kind of interesting that you have that family background, but it really doesn't mean anything because we're all the same.
How would I react to that?
Yeah, or react or respond if you were in a conversation and someone, you know, and they're not being mean. They really, you know, they think they're bonding with you.
Well,
when they
usually
say it.
When that happens, it means that they're really not taking the time to get to know me, who I am with all everything. And I have to say that somebody who would say that to me now would be, I would see it as dismissive only because one of the foundations of my ministry really is this idea of ancestry. I feel like what I've come to understand in this work for myself is that I feel like each of us is the best that our family has produced, that each of us is the flower of the plant. And so it becomes incumbent on us to evolve, to become even more than where we came from, even more than where our families went, just like it'll become incumbent on my daughter to become more too. You know, she's the best that the family has ever produced. And
mm-hmm.
So she'll go further. And I expect that to happen. She'll go places and think things I've never even dreamed of. And I hope that's true, because that means that evolution is at play there. So if somebody says to me, well, gosh, we're all the same in spirit and da-da-da-da-da, well, they're really not seeing me but looking at their own idea of me. And so, and that might be all right, too. They might just need that for the moment to move on with themselves. But really, to know me in my ministry is to really have to deal with not only me, but then themselves, that person's own background in terms of their own family and where the evolution is. Because usually those kinds of statements are really about people's denial about themselves, not really about the other person.
Yeah, and our denial are simply lack of awareness about, you know, a lot of times people who are from whatever the dominant group is in a situation are operating on automatic. And so they've never had to stop and ask themselves the question, like, how does my culture influence who I am and how I experience life? So it's not, sometimes it's denial and sometimes it's, I'm not even really aware that it has an impact.
Well, and the other thing too is like I've even had occasion where people, other Hispanics, assume I'm just like them, whatever that means, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't stop to ask me, well, gosh, we're all, and that it'll, the same question will, or the same statement will come out of them. Well, you know, we're all one here, and it's
mm-hmm.
like, well, okay.
Right, and when we know there's such a big difference, but a distinction mm-hmm. that results depending on, you know, your family background, your ancestry, where you've grown up, all of that. And, yeah, I agree with you that even if everyone is in the same big identity group by race or ethnicity, there's still distinctions within that group.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of things. One reason I wanted to ask you that question, the question of how do you define or describe your racial and ethnic identity, is because I wanted to model for our listeners how you can ask the question. And I knew that you would have an interesting response that would also model that, you know, most of the time people are happy to share with you what's important to them from their culture and their background, and that's a big part of being inclusive. You can't be inclusive when you don't know what's important to people.
Mm-hmm.
And then I learned something really fabulous, because I didn't really know that this idea of ancestry is a part of the foundation, you know, the foundational support for a lot of what you do in your ministry.
Mm-hmm.
So I've asked you a couple of questions just to kind of lay a foundation. And I also really want to listen. So when I invited you to be a guest on Intentionally Inclusive, I'm guessing you had some ideas that immediately came to mind about why this was a topic of interest for you and what you might bring forth in a conversation about leaders being intentionally inclusive. So I'm very happy to just kind of sit in the passenger seat and let you drive for a while, because I don't want us to get to, you know, the end of our time together and miss something really important because I didn't ask you the right question.
Okay. All right. Did you want me to start now, or do you want to start off on with a certain question, or?
No. So why did you say yes to Intentionally Inclusive, and just what about this topic really made you raise your hand and say, yes, I want to be on the schedule?
Well, one, I love the work that you're doing, because I've had occasion, I'm a member of the Diversity Commission, and I've had occasion to work with you in that capacity, and I've really enjoyed watching you work, and I've really come to admire the work that you do and the skill with which you do it. So number one, that was like a big huge reason, because I just really enjoy what you do. And The second reason is because I often feel like when we go to heaven, which is what where we are right now, but we're walking through a world just filled with people from every shape, size, gender, race, culture. It's so beautiful. It's like walking through a field of flowers, you know, and just admiring every single one.
Mm-hmm.
On Sundays, when I look out into the congregation and I see every kind of person, you know, race, color, gender, you know, I feel like this is heaven. This is exactly what heaven is. Is to know on this level, to know that that's exactly the way the world is, and that I am in our and the community, and I'll talk to you about the community in a second because we're relatively new. To know that this is heaven on earth, that's what we're recreating here, and the second one, when it comes to spirituality, the great, you know, when it comes to spirituality, the great lesson is to know the soul in its nth degree. I mean, because we're not as Ernest Holmes, our founder, says, we're not individuals, but individualized expressions of the one living God.
Mm-hmm.
And so as an individualized expression of that one living God, then I want to know all my brothers and sisters, because that's the rest of the story, right? My motivation, it's a motivation for inclusivity is really to know myself, you know, to know myself as the, you know, Native American brother or sister, to know myself as an African American brother or sister, as the other Hispanic brothers and sisters, as the Anglo-American, you know, brothers and sisters, all of it, to know that. And because otherwise, there's something missing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to, so my motivation is to know myself just the way that I am. Just the way that I am. And so my perceptions, so again, my perception of something is really how much I can be in, I'm trying to think of how to put this. My perceptions are really my ability to accept the world just the way it is. Ability to know, the ability to know a star or an atom is really in my perception, in a person's perception, to know the star or the atom, because one component is part of the rest of the component. And so it's a building block to the larger part. So if I include everybody, it's a building block to the larger, it's a building block to the larger picture. And so Dr. Holmes actually calls this the prime relationship. Our perceptions are our prime relationship. Our prime relationship is not with each other, not with the environment, nothing. My prime relationship is with my own perception. And if my own perception doesn't allow me to go beyond someone's whatever, I'm the poorer for it. I'm the poorer for it. And I guess the third thing that is motivation for this, which I guess is the radical in me, maybe not so radical, but I feel that way, is I'm taking religion back. I'm taking it back.
There's
a group of people out there who have been espousing religion as, you know, God is only for the privileged, God is only for the few, or God is only for if you look this way, or you're that way, or you love these people and not those people. And that's not true. Take it back. It looks like this community. Take it back. And so the other aspect is that it's time to take back that spirituality, redefine religion, and make it into something that is doable for everybody. And not just because it becomes doable for everybody, but because if people really loved each other, if I could see if I'm the individualized expression of the one living God, then it makes every single person that comes into my purview important. And if I think you're important, my ability to hurt you is going to be lessened. So the huge reason to be inclusive in the community is because by doing that, to love somebody that way is the most radical thing any of us can do. That changes the face of politics. That changes the world. And so that's the reason I do it.
Wow, those are some really powerful reasons and motivations, and I'm not at all surprised, but I love the way that you articulate it and put it in a package that is really very complete. I mean, there's the spiritual grounding of it, there's the practicality of it, there's the personal experience of it, and there's the politics of it. I mean, it's not just, as some people mistakenly assume, oh, either we're talking about diversity and inclusion in spiritual communities because we're trying to be politically correct and just, you know, not really deal with any issues, but it's just kind of like the vogue thing to do. You know, and it's like, no, there's a much bigger and a much deeper reason for it. And if you stand on spiritual ground, you know, I love that you started with, you know, this image of heaven being a place where there are all kinds of people. And if we believe as above, so below,
yes,
you know, then yes, I love that you can stand on Sunday and look out and see all kinds of people and know that all of those different kinds of people are in community together.
Yes.
How cool is that? So you said you were going to share a little bit about your community, and especially as it relates to diversity and inclusion. So.
Yes. Well, the name of the community here is called Rio Grande Center for Spiritual Living, and so we have the main river in New Mexico is called the Rio Grande, the big river, and it starts in the headwaters of southern Colorado. So if you see a picture of the headwaters of the Rio Grande, it's really kind of unremarkable. You know, you almost don't even know that that's what's going on there, that there's a river being formed, because it's all of these trickles of water that all come together. And eventually they come together in such a way that it becomes the river. And then as the river continues onward, it finally dumps out into the ocean, and so likewise, the way that our community was formed, the name, reason we called it the Rio Grande Center for Spiritual Living, is because, you know, individuals all arrive and, you know, you're just kind of looking at these people and they're just people, you know, but when they come together as individuals, then they become this river of people, and then they dump out into God. You know, it changes the consciousness of God. And so we got started in 2009. We've grown relatively quickly. We have we just moved to a new location in December. Well, January 1st of this year, we moved into a new location, and there were so many people coming. We had to go to two services. I'm happy to say by February the 1st. So we have two services at 9 and at 11, and we have about, I guess, collectively, we have about 150 people that show up right now on Sundays.
Nice.
And so we're about, I guess, 4.5 years old. And when we started, we started with this, one of the stories that we started with was in Your Aladdin's Lamp. There is a story about Dr. Holmes being given a hard time because he's allowing African Americans to come to services on Sunday. And he, in this story, he decides to address the issue, and he says that the third minister that he ordained was an African American. And so in the story, he addresses it. Everybody is gathered, and he comes to address this issue of having people who are not Caucasian. That was the word he used at the time in his services. And he says in the story, or it's actually Dr. Hornaday telling the story, that Dr. Holmes walks up to the front of the room and he stands behind the rostrum, and he said, and he stands there for the longest time. He stands there so long you could hear a pin drop, like nobody's moving because they want to hear what he has to say about this. And finally, Dr. Holmes begins to speak, and he says, I have been told that there are too many non-Caucasians in the services. He says, it is true, there are many Caucasians and many non-Caucasians in the community. And he says, that every single man, woman, and child is important to the Creator. If it were not so, they would not be here. Because of that, we think that they're important too, and our doors will forever be open to all. And that was such an inspiring story to this community that we wanted to make sure that that was true too. I mean, I have my personal beliefs about inclusivity and diversity, but it's one of the reasons that I love this philosophy and I love this teaching, is that it's that acknowledgement that every single person on the planet is important. Every single person, an individualized expression of the one living God. If that were not true, every person would not be here. We're here to know the experience of our own lives and to experience that of another through this life. So we're here to have it all, you know, the messiness, the happiness, the sloppiness, the not being perfectness, the humanity of it all. That's why we're here. And to say that somebody needs to be perfect or look a certain way or be a certain some way is really to diminish not only that person's experience of their life, but to diminish our own.
Absolutely. And every time I hear that story or read it, it just takes my breath away. And it is one of the reasons for me as well that I am so clear. I have such clarity that within religious science, especially within Science of Mind, that from the very beginning, Ernest Holmes had no confusion about inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was a no-brainer. It wasn't a political statement. It was a spiritual truth that guided him in being inclusive. Regardless, you know, when you think about what was the United States like in the, from 1918 to 1935 or 40, during the early years of the movement? And it was not a place that was equally inclusive. It was not a place for equity, and not just based on race, and lots of other identity groups as well. So to know that when you used the word earlier, ancestry, our ancestry in religious science includes the founder being very clear about this.
Yes. Yes. And actually, it's a denial of our own ancestry if people decide that not everyone can be included. You know, it would really be go fly in the face of our roots here.
Right. So you know, as I know, that most of the time people who are in leadership roles, so ministers, practitioners, lay leaders, you know, our lay members who coordinate ministry teams or coordinate events, all of us are leaders in certain ways, you know, and all of us have our ministries. So I think your experience, I'm guessing your experience is similar to mine, that typically people don't intentionally exclude. I mean, they don't intentionally say, okay, well, people who fit in this group are not welcome here. And generally, people will say, well, anybody's welcome. Everybody's welcome. We're here. We welcome everyone. Yet, the experience of someone who's different in some way doesn't feel welcomed, or they feel invisible, or they feel discounted or dismissed. So I don't know. I'm not even sure what the question is. I think maybe we could just talk about that situation and, you know, what are some things that we could, as leaders, keep in mind that would help help create an environment where lots of different people will come and will be involved.
Well, I think there's something that I've noticed with every person is that they have to want to be seen. There are some people that arrive that if you try to pull them in prematurely, you're doing them a disservice and yourself a disservice. It's almost like Parker Palmer's description of the soul is that you have to, it's like the soul is like a wild beast that you have to allow to come out of the bushes and come out of the woods. And so some people jump right in. They come right in, and I admire those people. I really do. They'll say, "Hi, I'm here. Who are you? How's it going?" Da da da. You know, I love mm-hmm. those people. They're great people. And then you've got the folks. I was one of these who they just gotta check out the lay of the land, see if the people are friendly, see if they're going to be rejected. There's like all these things they've got to see. And with those people, there's a way of being with them that you have to welcome them and at the same time let them decide, you know, what it is that they need from you and what it is that they feel like they want to do. And so there isn't a one-size-fits-all sort of approach.
Mm-hmm.
It all depends on where you are, who the people are, you know, what the day is even sometimes, you know, because sometimes you might get more observers than you might get the active participant people, you know. And I've had folks come up, you go, "I didn't want to stand up." You know, they'll tell me, "I didn't want to stand up because I just don't want to be, I don't want to be seen like that, but I wanted mm-hmm. to say hello to you," or, you know. So it just depends, you know, I think, but one of the overarching things that I think we need to do as communities is just keep cultivating that love, keep cultivating that acceptance of each other, be open to when we see people just hello, you know, sometimes not too strong of a hello because that might chase some people off. You know, there are, you know, oh my God, they said hi too hard. I've got to leave now, you know.
Right. Oh, they hugged me. Oh no, I can't stand to be hugged.
I know what that. You know, I'm not coming back. But, you know, it's really just kind of it's being sensitive, keeping an atmosphere that's really inclusive. That's just like one of the things I'm working on right now is just having, I want to put a what we believe in, just write it inside the door as you walk in so that people can know that they're there. We have on the front of our bulletin, the little quote from Dr. Holmes, every man, woman, and child is important to the Creator, blah, blah, blah. Our doors are forever open to all. It becomes important so that as people look around that they see inclusive kinds of symbols. You know, they see faces that look like their face, or people that are come from similar cultures as them all around. But what about, what about the folks that start coming in who maybe they haven't, we don't have folks like them here yet. And, I think it's a delicate balance, but I think it's creating the atmosphere of inclusivity, of just being very conscious of, do we have things up? Do we have things around that indicate to people that we are open to them? What do we have here that would appear, that would give somebody the idea that they were involved, that they were welcomed? And
right.
So,
I agree with you. I'm just really jumping in to agree with you. And I think, for me as an African-American woman, it's not just, sure, I walk in and I scan a room or I scan a center and I'm looking to see, are there any other black folks here? But when they're not, that alone doesn't bother me completely, depending on the demographics of the city or the town or the area. What's more important is that I see that there is some variety. So it's not just that you have to have other black people, but that, there are different kinds of people in different roles. Because what that tells me is that I can be myself. I'm not expected to be a cookie cutter of, there are 99 people who are all the same and I'm the only one who's different. And I think that's true for a lot of people and not just by ethnicity. So if we look at sexual orientation, some people will say, well, of course, I can't tell who's gay or lesbian or who's transgender. I can't tell, that just by looking at someone. But if I see that there is a lot of diversity in ways I can see. Are there people with disabilities? Are there people of different age groups? Are there people with different, are there other ways that difference is present? Because what that tells me is this is a group of people who can navigate differences. And then I'm willing to, show up as me, cautiously at first, but at least I'm not assuming every conversation's going to be like a breakthrough conversation. And I love your example of the signs. So it's signs and symbols. And, whether it's postcards or whether it's the what we believe sign, what's on your bulletin that allows people to see that there really is a place for them in this community.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We will send out on the web, our website, we'll send out, we put up little videos about, my talk for the coming Sunday. And, we intentionally put in pictures of people from, every walk of life so that as people are seeing that video, they know that they would be welcome to come and hear me, speak too. And that it's not just, so we're very intentional about the pictures that we show in those videos. And because we want people to know that they're invited, that they're welcome to come. And so it's we do that and that's that we do that intentionally because we really want to make sure that people feel welcome when they come.
Yeah, and I love what you just reminded me of. So often we don't even realize, we don't even recognize that we're sending a subtle message that everyone needs to be upper middle class, for example, you know, by the images we use, or that everyone must work in, you know, or our community is full of people who work in professional positions. And some of that is because when you're, you know, looking at stock photos and you're, you know, buying photos to use, you know, there's an abundance of photos with people who kind of represent a certain socioeconomic level or type of job. So it really does take intentionality to look a little bit further or to try different sites and find images of the blue-collar worker, find images of families that are multiracial, biracial or multiracial, to find images that, you know, have someone in a wheelchair or using Braille. It does require you to be intentional, because otherwise if you're just on automatic, it's easy to find images and graphics that are more similar than showing that you really are paying attention to diversity.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is there anything you have had to do, and it's perfectly okay if the answer is no, but is there anything that you've done or needed to do to provide training to members of your community so that they really are effective as ambassadors, as greeters, as people who are welcoming to those who are different from themselves?
You know, we haven't. We have not done that. Yes, we have not. I feel like we've been fortunate. Well, it's not. It goes beyond that. I was going to say that, but it's. I want to use deliberate language. We, the group of people that are drawn to this community, are a group of very conscientious people,
mm-hmm.
and the folks that seem to be drawn here are folks that have been long-term seekers. They've, you know, they're the people who have gone down different spiritual paths, or they've been studying a long time, or, you know, it just, and they seem to resonate here. And I think with that, with the person who's been studying a long time, there comes a point where they recognize, where each of us who've been doing our spiritual work, that we look at someone and we don't see the outside so much anymore. We look
mm-hmm.
in their souls. And when we're speaking at the level of soul, suddenly everything that we are comes into the conversation. So it's no longer just about being an Hispanic woman talking to an African American woman. It's not about that anymore. It's like, what do you know about God that you can tell me?
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about that.
And that is a great question. What do you know about God that you can tell me? And not in a defiant way, but in a juicy, delicious, warm, welcoming way. Because if you ask me that question, if someone asks me that question, so much of what I know is absolutely true about God does come from the fact that my ancestors were brought over to the United States through slavery, and the perseverance and the creativity and the being grounded spiritually that has come, you know, from generation to generation to generation is a lot of what grounds me in my spiritual truth. So that, along with things that have nothing to do with race and ethnicity, if we're talking at that level, you are going to learn about all the things that have influenced my understanding and my way of expressing spirit now.
Yes.
And just FYI, I was having a conversation, this was a few years ago, maybe 4 years ago now, with Reverend Cheryl Ward from at Agape International Spiritual Center. And we had it was a brief conversation, but I was asking her about diversity and inclusion at Agape and had almost the same question I asked you. Along the way, over, you know, in the first 10 years, was there anything that was done intentionally to help people be more comfortable with one another, because Agape has always had such a mix of different kinds of people from race, ethnicity, socioeconomics, and sexual orientation, lots of other different ways. And we had this great conversation that came from her saying, you know, actually, no, we never ever talked about diversity. We talked about love. And we laid a foundation, and we constantly went back to the consciousness of love for all people and being a place where all people who come will feel loved. And as a result of that, lots of people came who didn't feel loved in other communities.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime there seemed to be some conflict or some challenge, especially based on identity groups, that they would always go back to, we are a community of love, and how can we bring love present here into this conversation, into this situation, into this discomfort that we are having with one another. And they just consistently held consciousness for love.
Mm. Yes, that's our mission statement is to become the person God intended us to be, and to
mm-hmm.
support others to become the same.
Nice.
So we all feel that the best thing any of us can do for the planet is just to become that person we were intended to be. And so it's that same, it's another way of saying love. And then if I'm supporting you for your highest good, then nobody can go wrong. If I'm living in my highest level of consciousness and supporting you to do the same, and you're supporting me to do the same, only good can come from that.
So our time is winding down. We still have about 4 minutes, and I'm just curious, is there anything that you really wanted to share that was related to being intentionally inclusive that hasn't come up yet?
No, I think we've covered it. I think, if anything, this idea of, you know, tell me about your divine self and I'll tell you about mine, is really, because I think when we're speaking at the level of soul, that's a language everyone understands. And when we're speaking at the level of soul, we also necessarily get to know all about the person, their outer trappings and their inner trappings, because all of it comes to the table when we have a conversation on that level. All of it.
Yes.
And so, if I'm telling you about my journey to ministry, I have to tell you about my cultural background, because that was the doorway that I opened. That was the door I opened so I could walk in here.
Mm-hmm.
It had to happen that way. So you have to know about that if you ask me that question. So on the level of spirituality, at the level of soul to soul speak, if the conversation is left there rather than just on the outer appearances, if you ask me, are you Hispanic, and I just say yes, well, you don't know anything else about me. You don't know why, you know, you don't know who I am or what I do or what's important to me. All you know is that you're Hispanic. But if you say, you know, what is it, you know, what is who is your God, or what is, you know, how do you experience the divine? All of it comes to bear then. All of it. And, you know, and more, because the dialogue then allows both participants to know more, not only about each other, but about themselves by the time it's over.
Exactly. One of the things I talk about a lot, given the opportunity to talk about this topic in spiritual communities, especially in New Thought spiritual communities, whether it's Centers for Spiritual Living or Unity or Divine Science or Foundation for Better Living, it's this idea that I can only experience directly, you know, my part of God expressing. And when I get to meet other people who are different from me, you know, in significant ways, I get the gift of knowing more about God. And on a personal level, that's really powerful for me and keeps me open and keeps me, you know, willing to explore diversity and inclusion. From a ministry perspective and being a leader in a community, in a spiritual community, I think it's fascinating that we can also do that and realize we are bringing into our Sunday service or our Wednesday class or our, you know, into whatever event we're having, we are being open to all the different ways that God is experiencing that event.
Yes.
And it's not always easy.
No.
But one of the things I got from talking to you today is that it's very enriching.
Yes, and worth the effort.
Yeah. So our time really is up. It goes so fast. And if you're listening in live or you're listening to the recording, what I want to remind you is that this entire series, Intentionally Inclusive, is available on iTunes. It is available as a podcast. And the goal is that we create a little library of, you know, 20 to 30 candid conversations from real people who are committed to being inclusive in spiritual community. So I hope you, like me, enjoyed this conversation with Reverend Martha Quintana from the Rio Grande Center for Spiritual Living in Albuquerque. I really appreciate you taking the time, Martha, and I know that we will probably be talking again soon.
Yes, we will. Thanks for asking me. I really enjoyed this conversation. Have a great one.
Thanks. Everybody visit stainedglassspirit.net. There is a tab for Intentionally Inclusive where you can get more information, get the dial-in number, and get access to the schedule. Bye for now.